From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Brazilian film director José Padilha has jumped deep into the world of drug trafficking for his new Netflix series, Narcos. It's set not in the contemporary Mexico of El Chapo right now, but in 1980s Colombia, Medellin, and the world of the 80s king of cocaine, Pablo Escobar. It's gripping and lights up the drug trade then and now. This hour on Point, director, producer, co-creator José Padilha on The King of Cocaine and Netflix Narcos. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen Narcos? What did you learn or remember of the 80s avalanche of cocaine? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A little of the soundtrack of Narcos right there behind us. Let's listen to a little bit of the back and forth. First big bilingual series here. The Spanish characters, those playing Colombians, speak Spanish in this. You'll read a lot of this below the spoken narrative. But there is a narrator in Narcos. Here is DEA agent Steve Murphy from the show, played by Boyd Holbrook, argues with his Colombian counterpart here, played by Maurice Comte, about their strategy for taking down Pablo Escobar.
Extradition doesn't mean anything unless you can catch him.
So our help, you will.
Oh, that's right. Gringos to the rescue.
It's one man against the United States of America.
One man with helicopters, airplanes, vehicles, planned escape routes, and a network of informants everywhere.
Our government will provide money, men, weapons.
You make it sound so easy. But Escobar has always managed to stay one step ahead of us.
And it makes a pretty gripping story. Joining me first today from Culver City, California, is José Padilha, producer, director, co-creator of the hot new Netflix series Narcos. 10 episodes released last Friday. José Padilha, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. 1980s and Pablo Escobar, I remember it. I was skeptical that I could be so taken in by the story going back to it, but I was. It's gripping. I congratulate you. What made you think that in 2015, when there's all kinds of contemporary drug lords to watch and drug news to watch and follow, that viewers would want to go back to the 1980s and cocaine then?
Well, there are many reasons, Tom, but mostly because the history of the cocaine trade is a recurring history of a recurring mistake, unfortunately. And what I mean by that is that when you watch Narcos, and the idea is to tell the history of cocaine from Pablo Escobar, the inception of the mass production and export of cocaine into America up to today, up to Chapo Guzman. So we want to cover the whole history of this drug trade, right?
Okay.
So when you look at that from this perspective, very broad perspective, what you see is that there was a choice made back then to deal with the drug problem by trying to prevent suppliers, or by fighting suppliers, by waging war on suppliers of drugs, but at the same time ignoring the demand. So once you couch the problem this way, it becomes a police problem, a military problem, instead of a social, a public health problem. And what we see then from this vantage point is that, you know, America starts waging war on the Medellin cartel, on Pablo Escobar. And by the time they get Pablo Escobar, the Medellin cartel is already irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And there is another cartel, the Cali cartel, from another city that's supplying the cocaine through other routes instead of Miami, New York. Then they go after the Cali cartel. And by the time they get to the Cali cartel, the FARCs are doing it, and all the way through to today in Mexico. So what we see is that we wage war on suppliers, we kill a supplier, then another supplier pops up, just because we never deal with the demand. And what I think you get, and what interested me on the series, was by taking this high vantage point and broad perspective, people can figure out that we need to deal with the drug issue by tackling the demand issue, by shifting paradigms and thinking about it as a social issue and as a health problem.
I mean, a recurring story, there's no question about that. And just there in your thumbnail, you tell it compellingly. But yet, in the 1980s, where Narcos begins, a lot of people, Pablo Escobar, as you portray him anyway, not very familiar with cocaine and its effects, sort of amazed at the impact of this drug, how much people would pay for it, how they would go after it. It seems as though it was coming into kind of virgin territory for many people then.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Pablo Escobar, the way I see him after doing all this research, is he was, at the time, he was a smuggler, a medium-sized criminal, but he was also a megalomaniac and a sociopath and a ruthless business person. And he just happened to stumble into this product, into cocaine, that was sold by the gram, so easy to transport, that was very cheap to produce, and that could reach amazing prices in America. And he figured that out. So he created this export routes, smuggling routes into America, and he hit the jackpot, basically. So it's the story of a megalomaniac guy who thought he would be big, and he actually happened to become big. and like, you know, it's kind of ironic. And like, like Icarus, you know, he couldn't stop himself from flying higher and higher. At a certain point in time, he decided he was going to be a congressman, and he wanted to be the president of Colombia, you know. And he actually ran for Congress and got elected. And so this is the story of a, you know, at one side, a visionary criminal who opened up the market of cocaine to the whole world, massificating production and creating... He would have submarines built to send cocaine from Colombia to Miami. He would have so many different creative drug routes on one end, and on the other end, he would be incredibly ruthless and violent to control the market. And that combination, I think, explains the boom of cocaine, first in Miami and then throughout America.
And megalomaniac, no doubt it as portrayed, no doubt about it as portrayed here. Here's a little bit from episode one, with Pablo Escobar, played by the Brazilian actor, really terrifically, Wagner Moura, is driving along. He's stopped by Colombian police. He's not used to being stopped. He's got a convoy that is ready to smuggle. And this is before cocaine. This is televisions and other smuggling stuff. And he spends a little time toying with them, makes it clear to them finally that he knows all about their personal lives. They shouldn't mess with him, and then makes this speech standing in the road in the boondocks of Colombia.
Señores, les voy a decir quién soy. Yo soy Pablo Emilio Escobar Gaviria.
Now, it's a bilingual show, forgive me. Not everyone's going to follow this. He says, gentlemen, I'm going to tell you who I am. I am Pablo Emilio Escobar Gaviria. My eyes are everywhere. That means you guys, the police, can't move a finger in all of Antioquia without me knowing about it. Do you understand? Not a finger. One day, he says, I'm going to be the president of the Republic of Colombia. So look, I make deals for a living. Now you can stay calm and accept my deal or accept the consequences. Silver, he says, or lead.
Aceptar las consecuencias. Plata o plomo.
Plata o plomo. Ooh, silver or lead. Take the money or take a bullet. Did he say, I'm going to be president of Colombia? Was that for real? And was that his motto, silver or lead, for those who would oppose him?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was one of the reasons I say he was a megalomaniac. He's known to have stated, and this is in several books, that he would put a bullet in his own head if he didn't make $1 million by the time he was 21. And, well, he did.
And soon so, billions.
Yeah. And then he was number six in Forbes magazine. And the second guy...
On the list of billionaires, that is. Yeah.
Exactly. On the list of billionaires.
Globally.
And then the second... The second guy on the hierarchy of the Medellin cartel was Gacha, the Mexican, who also operated out of Medellin. And he was number nine. And then the third group was number 11. All of those guys in the Forbes magazine. So the amount of money and the speed into which they made their money was unprecedented. Never seen. I mean, current nowadays drug dealers are not even close to that.
Pablo Escobar had a profit margin on cocaine that no longer exists. Chapo Guzman is small in comparison to Pablo Escobar. Not even close, by the way.
I mean, he was making very quickly billions. The way you portray him scaling up the production would make Henry Ford blush. From these little jungle labs to suddenly very large scale and dealing literally billions in cash out of the U.S. Very, very early on in his cocaine trafficking.
Yeah, I mean, one of the funny things that we show in the story that's true is that he just didn't know what to do with the money because he didn't have a structure.
The actual cash, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't know what to do. I mean, there was because he had two problems, basically, Pablo Escobar in the beginning. Mm. One was, how do I get cocaine to America? That problem he solved quickly and easily, first because America wasn't looking for cocaine. All America cared about at that time was grass, how to stop
Hot,
the marijuana
right,
trade.
Right.
Pot, yeah. And so he figured that out easily. But the amount of cash that was being sent back, and money occupies a way bigger volume than cocaine, was problematic for him. He had planes flying back from Miami to Colombia fill up to the brim with cash. And once the cash got there, it was accumulating so fast that, and he didn't trust the banks and he couldn't show the money, that he had to bury it.
Jose Padilla, please stand by. I hate to break in, but we've got more time. I want to talk. It's great to have you. The new series is Narcos on Netflix. It's terrific. Jose Padilla, Brazilian filmmaker, is with us. He's co-creator, director of the first couple of episodes, producer, screenwriter for Narcos. Listeners, you can join us. Are you watching Narcos? Are you hooked? Do you remember when cocaine just exploded over America? Were you hooked on that? Were you a trafficker? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Jose Padilla, please stand by in Culver City, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new Netflix series Narcos on the 1980s rise of the king of cocaine, Pablo Escobar, out of Colombia, with a Brazilian director, the first couple episodes, and producer Jose Padilla. He joins us from California today. And for a broader look at drug trafficking then and now, Sam Quiñones will join us in a minute, longtime reporter on the trade for the Los Angeles Times and more. You can join us this hour. Are you watching Narcos? Are you hooked? Were you there for all that? And what was your sense of Pablo Escobar down in Medellin? Robin Hood? Killer? Drug? Monster? If you've seen Narcos, what do you think of the way Jose Padilla tells the story, portrays the people, the violence, the politics, the megalomania? And is it very different now? Escobar versus El Chapo? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK, a little of the Narcos soundtrack there. This composed Gaucha's Troubles by Pedro Bronfman there. A little more, it's bilingual in this way. The narration is by a DEA agent who's in Colombia. But when the Colombians speak to one another, and there's a lot of that, it's all subtitles. So be ready to read. But it is gripping. I didn't know what to expect here. It's pretty terrific. Here's a bit from episode 2 of Narcos, where Gustavo Gaviria, played by Juan Pablo Raba, tells Pablo Escobar he's concerned that they're going to get caught, that there's just so much money they don't know what to do with it. Escobar, played by Wagner Moura, the Brazilian actor, assures him they'll be okay. Just do what Al Capone did.
La gente nos está mirando, Pablo.
He says, people are watching us, Pablo. They're asking themselves how two small businessmen suddenly came up with so much cash. And Escobar says, just launder the money, make it look legitimate. That's all. Isn't that what Al Capone did? A taxi company was the cover. They had a couple of cars and billions coming in. Here's a bit in English from the first episode. The American DEA agent, Steve Murphy, played by Boyd Holbrook, says the U.S. really only started taking action on drug trafficking around cocaine when people realized how much money was involved. There was death, yes. From 1979 to 1984, he says,
there were 3,245 murders in Miami. And outside the tourist bureau and the cops, no one much cared about that. What got the U.S. government to take notice was the money. Billions of dollars a year, all flowing from the U.S. to Colombia. And that America can take.
From Narcos, thousands of murders in Miami, and yes, those were very many of them, cocaine murders. Couldn't take it, though, when billions started flowing out, bundle after bundle after bundle. September 14th, 1986, it's in Narcos, you may remember it. Then President Ronald Reagan talked about drugs.
Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children.
And on came the war on drugs, and Nancy Reagan with Just Say No. Mike is calling from Miami, Florida. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Jose Padilla in California.
I'm doing.
Hi, Mike. You're on.
Good. I actually grew up in Miami pretty much all the ages. I was there. I was a kid, 10 years old, up until I left in 92. And I remember everything pretty clearly. It was crazy. The cocaine cowboy syndrome in Miami, and friends of mine whose parents I didn't know at the time were drug dealers. All of a sudden, middle class, lower middle class, Cubans and Colombians would just blow up and have a $10 million mansion, race boats, Porsches, Ferraris, Mercedes. And some families, I remember, all of a sudden, you would have a raid, and either the police would get them and take everybody to jail, or some families, Colombians would come in and liquidate the entire family, including the dog and the grandmother, to just show a point, or between drug squabbles between one group and the other group. As a kid, a lot of times I couldn't even play outside. My parents preferred me play in the backyard or inside the house, because it was kind of dangerous in our neighborhood.
It sure could be. The money was rolling, and soon the blood was as well. Mike, you tell it almost as if it's right out of the script of Narcos, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Jose Padilla, it's sort of beguiling at the beginning when people are just giddy with how easy it is to smuggle it into the U.S. and how much money comes back. There's a kind of, let's just do this. And it looks so easy. It gets grim and huge and heavy pretty quickly. But the beginning was so, as you portray it, lighthearted. But then very quickly, here come the billions and here comes the blood.
Yeah, exactly. And with so much money involved, and also the effects of cocaine in the brain are pretty serious, and people were quick to caught up to understand what was happening. You know, people get hooked to cocaine because cocaine hits the pleasure centers on the brain, and it's very easy to get addicted. So this was a huge problem, because it was, as cocaine was spreading in Miami, addiction was spreading too, and the demand for cocaine was getting bigger and bigger. So all of this put a lot of pressure on the police, local police in Miami, but also on the police in Colombia. And there was a lot of deaths. And one of the things that strikes me as amazing is we have a lot of conscience by consumers about where products come from, mm-hmm. right? So some people would say, I'm not going to eat meat because of the way, cattle is treated, mm-hmm. or because, and that's fair and dandy, but they fail to look at what happens with cocaine. I mean, for anyone to get a gram of cocaine, there's so many people have to die in the process. Like, an innocent people, Pablo Escobar, for instance, in his war against the law enforcement in Colombia and mm-hmm. the American government, brought a whole plane down. He put a bomb in a plane to kill one politician who wasn't on board, by the way. Mm-hmm. And that's a 737 plane.
Wow.
And the plane exploded and 100 people died. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the violence that is connected with the supply of this product. And people should be aware of that. I mean, when I say there has to be a paradigm shift in the fight against war, against drugs,
mm-hmm.
and it has to be focused on health issues and social issues, a lot of that should be education. People should be educated about what it entails to do cocaine and to pay for cocaine, and where the money goes and what it does. It becomes guns, it becomes corruption, it's not a good product at all, you know?
Yeah, yeah. We've got people watching and responding here online on Twitter. Kafia says, it's so good, Narcos. I totally binged. I have one episode left, 10 out there already. Garrett says, I just started watching Narcos this week. My amount of sleep has greatly declined from midnight binge watching. One of the best shows out there today, period. It's pretty darn good. Justa Silva, props to you, says, so proud of Jose Padilla and W. Mora representing Brazil so well, continuing to work on social issues, as in Elite Squad. Scott is calling from, which was directed by Jose Padilla. Scott's calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. Florida callers on this one. Scott, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you guys doing?
Well, what do you know?
Well, it was a crazy time back then. I was 23 in Miami, and we were kind of low-level dealers. We were just trying to really make something to party with and then make a little bit of money.
You personally?
And it was just, yeah, myself and some friends.
Okay, okay.
And it was just, it was a crazy time. I mean, it, you know, we were young, we were stupid, but it's hard to describe unless you were in Miami at the time. It seemed probably in the circles that we were running that everybody was involved with it. So, you know, there was a restaurant down there, I'm not going to name the name of it, but they used to give out lines as tips to the waiters and waitresses. So
give, you know, lines of cocaine just to keep everything rolling.
And it seems like it's something out of a movie, but it was a reality. I mean, it was just a different world.
Yeah, a different world, no doubt. It's brought to the screen here by Netflix and Narcos. I thought I'd seen enough, but Jose Padilla, you make it pretty interesting. You're a documentarian also in your background. That comes through here, though. There's lots of drama. One of the things that you put front and center right at the beginning was that this trade began not in Colombia, but in Chile, and got put to rest there in a very, very heavy-handed fashion. Could you remind us of that?
Yes. I mean, the cocaine trade, most people don't know, started in Chile before Pinochet, when Allende was in power, and Allende was a left-wing mm-hmm. president. Then Nixon came to power in America. He backed up a coup, a right-wing coup, a dictator came on board. It was Pinochet, and Pinochet quickly decided to shut down all the cocaine labs, and he killed hundreds of drug dealers, if not thousands of drug dealers.
You have his soldiers just lining them up in front of trenches and killing them en masse, firing squads.
Exactly. So. Yeah, and that happened to the left-wing parties and to the people who had Marxist point of views, and also to the drug dealers. But one guy, one drug dealer, and this is true, he was in a lineup, he was going to be shot, and the bullets missed him, and he survived. And his name, amazingly enough, was Cockroach. Mm. And they say only the cockroaches will survive when a nuclear holocaust comes, and that's, I guess, it's true. Mm. And Cockroach then fled to Colombia with the knowledge of where to get cocaine. That was in Peru at the time.
And how to process it. Mm-hmm.
And how to process it. And he met Pablo Escobar. He was brought to Pablo Escobar. That's what triggered everything. So it's really interesting because one of the things you learn by looking at this is that intervention in foreign countries have unforeseen consequences. The fact that Henry Kissinger and Nixon decided to mm-hmm. intervene in Chile mm-hmm. jump-started the drug trade. You know, who would have thought that would happen?
Pinochet comes in, drives it out of Chile, and it gets into the hands of a megalomaniac, super ambitious guy in Colombia, access to Miami, off it goes.
Yeah, and then we have our friend who just called, who becomes a cocaine dealer in Miami because of that. You know what I mean? Everything is interconnected, and it's very hard to predict what the consequences are of big actions like interfere with a whole country, you know, like it happened with Chile back then.
Ana Maria in Kennesaw, Georgia. Ana Maria, thank you for calling. You're on with Jose Padilla.
Hi, Tom. Yeah. I'm with goosebumps already. I saw the first episode of Narcos. Mm-hmm. I used to live in Medellin. It's my hometown. All my family still lives there.
In Medellin. Wow, and okay.
Yeah, we used to be neighbors of Pablo Escobar. He lived right across the street from us in a building.
Get out of here. When he was rich or before he was rich?
No, he was already on his way to being richer, but he already was rich enough to get in one of the best neighborhoods in Colombia, which was Santa Maria de Los Angeles, where he bought a beautiful house that was a whole lot big, and then we saw the cars. When I was studying, I saw the cars going out. They went in, like, late at night. They went in the garage, empty, and you could see the cars heavy, loaded with coke in the back. That was before he was... you could see they have a kitchen underneath that big house. Then he tore it down, and they built this big, luxurious condo where only he lived, because he normally didn't stay more than 2 days or 3 days in the same place. He had so many informants. Me and my neighbors normally called on public phones to the police to let them know when he was there, and, of course, nothing ever happened because there were so many informants. Nothing. There was no raid being done. Of course, we knew better. We had to call some public phones.
This is unbelievable. You lived across the street from Pablo Escobar. That house that he turned into a coke lab is shown in Narcos. Perhaps you saw it there. What happened to the neighborhood, Ana Maria? Or did you run away?
No. We always lived there. The thing is that when the two cartels, the Cali, when he started playing those old dirty killings to everybody, the cartel and the Medellin cartel were in war. So the Cali cartel put a car bomb, tried to get a car bomb into the Monaco building. Monaco is the name of that building in that beautiful neighborhood. They couldn't put the car inside. So they because the guys from the entrance didn't allow it. They were not sure.
Yeah.
So the guy turned around and bought the car in the street that divided my house from his building. And it blew up at 5 something in the morning. And fortunately, only my brother was there, survived, but at that time we were in our farmhouse. But almost the whole, it was the first car bomb that was placed for citizens, not for the police, because he put a lot of bombs for the police, but this was the first one that was because of the war between the two cartels, and it blew our house away. We didn't have, and after that, of course, you know, the whole thing's changed, but it was after that everybody was afraid, and nobody wanted to go close where everybody knew where his properties were, but nobody could do anything because it's tough. I mean, people think it's very easy.
We've got it. Ana Maria, I'm so grateful for your call. It's just amazing. Thank you for calling in from Georgia. Jose Padilla, how about a call-in radio? You never know what you're going to get. And we often get right to the heart of it. This is Pablo Escobar's neighbor. Her family's house blown up by a car bomb in the fight with the Cali cartel there. More material for you, Mr. Director, Producer.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, I actually went to the Monaco building, and this explosion is portrayed in the series. The first 10 episodes, I believe it's episode 6. Mm. And now I'm talking to someone on the radio that was living right in front of the Monaco building.
Whose brother was there at 5 in the morning when the bomb went off.
Yeah, that bomb actually had very serious consequences. I mean, like I said before, when you go after the supplier of cocaine and you still have a big demand in America, Brazil, and other places, you get one supplier, another one shows up. And that was the beginning of the replacement of the Medellin cartel by the Cali cartel that would happen years later. And that bomb actually deeply affected Pablo Escobar's life because his daughter become partially deaf because of that. And it triggered an incredibly amount of violence in Colombia. Pablo Escobar, there was a time that Pablo Escobar would blow a bomb a day in Bogota and Medellin.
Wow.
I mean, it was just the sheer numbers of bombs that he blew up, that he used to blow up. And people thought he brought a guy from Ireland who used to help the IRA to, you know, create bombs so that they could learn how to make bombs. Like, these people were geared up for war in an amazing, violent way.
Jose Padilla is director of the first couple of episodes, producer of Narcos. It's a new Netflix series, 10 episodes, dropped just a few days ago. I'm into it. You might be too. Join us. 800-423-8255. Are you watching Narcos? Is it very different now? Escobar versus El Chapo, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman of Mexico. Has the heart of the drug business, the trade, changed? Sam Quiñones joins us from Los Angeles. As soon as we get back here, we want to compare with what's going on right now. 800-423-TALK. This is On Point with soundtrack here from Narcos. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new Netflix series Narcos on the 1980s rise of the king of cocaine, Pablo Escobar, with the Brazilian director, producer of Narcos, José Padilha. And we'll also take a look at the up-to-date drug trade as well, a little compare and contrast in just a moment here with Sam Quiñones. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. Have you watched Narcos? Do you remember the heyday of Pablo Escobar? Kind of incredible story. I thought I knew it well enough, had had enough of it. Well, José Padilha brings it back pretty strong in Narcos. Here's a little bit, episode 7, first 10 episodes have just dropped, where the actor playing Escobar prepares to turn himself over to authorities, but first he tells his partner here about his plan to build his own prison that he will then be imprisoned in, part of his plan to protect himself.
Me conozco cada centímetro de esas montañas.
Escobar is saying, I know every centimeter of these mountains. From here, where he wants to put his own prison, we can see anything coming, and we have enough space to build whatever we want. We're going to design it, we're going to build it, and we will be protected from all of our enemies. And Gabriel says, you want to build a jail? Escobar says, not a jail, cousin, a castle. A castle, not a jail, a castle that he'll live in. Of course, then comes the final episode of season one, bloody standoff between the Colombian military, Pablo Escobar's prison contingent. And bring it right up to date, just this summer, notorious Mexican drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman escaped from Mexican prison. Here's that report from NBC News.
It's the second escape for the notorious drug kingpin. Last time, he eluded police for 13 years before being recaptured a year and a half ago. This morning, Mexican police are desperately searching for the drug lord.
And the beat goes on. José Padilha says they're going to bring this story right up to date through the history of the cocaine trade, right up to El Chapo before it's all over. It's on Netflix now for the 1980s portion of all that. José Padilha joins us from Culver City, California. With us from Los Angeles, Sam Quiñones is here as well, freelance journalist focused on immigration, gangs, drug trafficking, Mexico. Was a reporter for the LA Times from 2004 to 2014, author of Dreamland and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. Sam Quiñones, welcome back to On Point. It's wonderful to have you here.
Good to be here again, Tom. How you doing?
I'm well. I think you've seen a little bit of Narcos, and I just wonder about the mood you get out of it from this 1980s, this portrayal of 1980s Pablo Escobar time versus the drug trade that you've covered more actively, Sam, and El Chapo right now.
Yes, I mean, congratulations to José. It's a terrific show and a really great piece of television, I think. I'm enjoying it for sure, simply as a viewer, not just so much as a student of it. One of the things that strikes me is that what's happening now is kind of grown out of the mistakes of Pablo Escobar, and the Medellin boys. The Mexican cartels really grew up because of the story that this series is going to tell. Eventually, their violence forced the Reagan administration and the Bush administration to effectively seal off the Florida route into the United States for the drugs. And so they couldn't take those speedboats anymore and the airplanes. That was effectively cut off. So what they had to do was shift into Mexico, all their drug trafficking. And at first, the Mexican, I wouldn't even call them cartels, the Mexican trafficking groups at the time were pretty unsophisticated hillbilly guys, and they became the mules, in a sense, the transit group that would just take the way it would work is the Colombians would take the cocaine into Mexico, and then the Mexicans would take it into L.A., where I'm about 15 miles from where I'm sitting now, is a big, large community, Mexican community, where they would funnel the drugs. Then the Colombians would come back into the United States and take the drugs and then traffic them around the United States. What ended up happening, of course, was that the Mexicans said, why do we need these Colombians? You know, from now on, we're just going to, they'll sell us the dope or they'll front us the dope, and we'll take it in ourselves and sell it ourselves in the United States. And cocaine, the amount of money involved in cocaine, far outstripped the other drugs that these traffickers were used to trafficking, which was usually bad quality marijuana and heroin.
Yeah.
And that allowed for the enormous run-up in arms and power. But also, the Mexicans learned another rule, I would say, or another lesson from the Colombians, and that was, do not go into strip malls and kill 10 people because you want to kill one person. Do not blow up cars, this kind of thing. And so you see the Mexican way of trafficking is the polar opposite of the kind of trafficking that you're going to see, I think, in this show, which is heavily reliant on guns and explosions and this kind of thing. It's far more under the radar once it gets into the United States, I'm referring to. So for example, you saw even as Mexico kind of was falling apart in this kind of medieval violence that we've seen over the last decade, you really saw almost no spillover of that into the United States. You saw Juarez has 3,000 murders a year and 100 yards across the river, and El Paso had less than 1% of that, like 20, 30 murders a year.
That is a really interesting story of the evolution here. I mean, Sam, stand by. Jose Padilla, do you see that evolution, that change? You're already showing the sort of Wild West violence that poured into Miami and Florida for a while there. But you hear Sam saying, look, the Mexicans learned a little something. Keep the crazy stuff on their own side of the border.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, hi, Sam, and the portrayal Sam gives is perfect. I mean, eventually, you could look at it in another way. You could look at it as the invisible hand of the market doing its work. Because, like I said, if the policy is to crush suppliers, and it's very hard to supply cocaine directly from Colombia to Miami, you have to have boats and planes.
Right.
But if you can get the cocaine to Mexico, or the paste to Mexico, and they can make the powder, Mexico has a frontier with the United States, so it's much more easier for the Mexican drug dealers to get the cocaine in. And also because there is a huge community of cocaine dealers in America, inside America, they can get the cocaine for this distribution network and just spread it. So the supplier ended up being exactly where the market would have it. It's the most efficient way to supply is through Mexico, and that's what we're going to tell throughout the seasons of Narcos.
Jose, with that documentarian view of what is also a pretty gripping drama, I mean, Sam, one big difference, and Jose Padilla referenced it before, but our listeners are out there doing their work. Pablo Escobar was on the list of richest men in the world, on the Forbes list, number 6 for a while. One of our listeners is looked back at the numbers, got his calculator out, and said, writes to us here, Matt, just calculated Pablo Escobar's net worth in 2015 dollars, $87 billion. El Chapo, estimated to be worth about $1 billion. That is a huge difference in scale, Sam.
No, there's another difference, and that is that Chapo Guzman's still alive. And Pablo Escobar died long ago. And that is the big difference. And that is the difference in all these things. You know, there was a reference to Al Capone earlier in the show. Precisely. That's the thing. You know, Al Capone was a kind of the early version of the cocaine cowboy, just with booze. And he reaped the rewards of that, in a sense, in a lot of ways, and ended up in prison. By the time he was 33, his career was finished. He was in Alcatraz. So what I'm saying is that I think what's been learned from the 80s, and it's not just the Colombians, but also the Bloods and Crips that took that cocaine, rocked it up into crack, and sold it across the country and various cities across the country, using, again, almost the Colombian model of, we're going to go in and blow everybody away, and we're going to have these endless feuds on street corners. And what ended up happening was a lot of those guys died. A lot of those guys went to prison. If you look at the way drugs are trafficked nowadays, you almost never have that kind of public violence. you do have some of it. It's not, but it's certainly nothing compared to what it was in the 80s and the 90s as the murder rate in Miami showed. I mean, the murder rate in Miami, the Colombians came in, the murder rate levitated. And so the other issue that I think is important in all this, though, is that not only did the Mexican traffickers have at their disposal a 1,952-mile border with the largest economy in the world, they also had the ability, because of the Mexican political system, to control the risk. By that, I mean they did not have any risk at all posed by their own government.
You mean, unlike the Colombian government as portrayed in Narcos, the Mexican government is not really coming after them?
Exactly, and it was a system. The Mexican one-party state that existed for so many years was really a system based on graft, on everybody gets a chance to turn at the public trough. And what ended up happening was the drug trafficking provided the biggest trough of all. And so, so really, the Mexican political elite and the criminal justice system really pose no risk, no threat to these guys. And that's another part. It's a huge part, I would say, not just another part. It's a huge part of the story of why a guy like Chapo Guzman now is in his third decade, basically, of kingpin status almost.
These are terrific revelations right here. Sam, stand by. And Jose, sure. David's calling Portland, Connecticut. David, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I'll be quick. I just wanted to point out the fact that this guy, Pablo, you know, kills cops, horrible guy, sells drugs. Yeah, the director or whoever portrays him in such a way where I really care about him and I want him to win, you know, because he's going for the poor people, and he's willing to fight, and it just really brings out him and how determined a person can be to get things done. And I really care about the guy. I don't want him to die.
It is fascinating, isn't it? Here's a little bit. Episode 3, Narcos, the character playing Pablo Escobar runs for office and ends up winning, getting into Congress. Here he is with the campaign speech.
Estoy cansado que la gente con poder maneje este país.
I'm tired of the people with power running this country. This is a fight between the people with power and the poor people, weak people, Escobar saying here, and this fight must begin here. To have power does not mean that one can abuse the poor. Jose Padilla, you were the director there. What about the Robin Hood visage that he wanted to present to the world? For real or only in his mind?
For real. I mean, in the beginning, Colombia, you have to understand that Colombia is a very specific place. That's why we quote magical realism in the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
The idea that crazy things will happen in the real context of Colombia. And Colombia had a very sectarian society in the sense that if you were poor, you'll be poor. There's no way, no social mobility in Colombia back in the day. And Pablo Escobar, for a while, in the eyes of the Colombians, was the guy who broke through. You know, he was a poor guy and became a billionaire, richer than everyone in the country.
Yeah.
So for a while, people thought, this is a model. This is the Paisa Robin Hood, the Robin Hood for Medellin. And he was actually praised in the biggest magazines in the country, in Bogota, until people realized what was going on. Now, going back to the comparison between Colombia and Mexico, I would say that because of the violence, the extreme violence of the Colombian drug dealers, as San has pointed out, the government in Colombia was quick to figure out that they had to do something. And they were also pressured by America because of the violence in Miami and the money flowing from Miami to Colombia. Now, in Mexico, it's a different ball game for sure. One, there is no violence in America, or there is no Mexican violence
pale
in comparison to what happens in Miami. Although there's a lot of violence in Mexico, I would say. I mean, just by the news we have, lots and lots of violence in Mexico. And eventually, I hope the Mexican government will wake up and things will become different than the way Sam described them to be.
We'll see. I have to ask you something, because Claudia writes to us here, and she says, as a Colombian-American, Escobar's story has been both intriguing and repulsive at the same time. She's watched the show. Great job of retelling. But she says, but I find the different accents of Spanish spoken very distracting. I wish the director would have cast more Colombian actors. And don't even get me started about Pablo Escobar's Brazilian accent. Why did you choose to use Wagner Moura? You've worked with him a lot in Elite Squad and more, I guess. But why did you he's terrific as Escobar. Why not a Colombian actor?
Right. I mean, a Colombian actor has played Pablo Escobar. Andres Parras did a great portrayal of Pablo Escobar in a show in Colombia, in a Colombia soap opera. I chose to be, this is a Netflix show, yeah. And Netflix is global. So we are not aiming solely at a Colombian audience, though we are getting great results in Colombia. We wanted it to be seen by everybody. And that's when I got a little bit of, I had my own dream, which was have a cast that had great actors from all of Latin countries, from Mexico, from Brazil, from Peru, from Chile. So I could cast all these guys, have sort of like a dream team of actors to work with me. And the barrier was, do I care about the accent? Because, you know, there are several different Spanish accents.
Yes.
And I decided, no, I'm not going to. I think the story will be gripping enough, powerful enough, to hook people without a concern for the accent. And that's what I'm finding out, you know, in all the tweets and all the internet response. People go with it despite the different Spanish accents and they forget about it.
Sam Quiñones, you're our expert. Are you in? You watched one episode. Are you back for more of Narcos?
Oh, sure. Oh, I love the show. I think it's really nicely done. The accents don't bother me actually that much. I'm intrigued to see how it deals with the Mexico transition after
season one as we go on. Sam Quiñones, author of Dreamland and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream. Wonderful as always to have you with us, Sam. Thank you very much for being with us from L.A.
Thank you.
Jose Padilla, co-creator, director of the first couple episodes of Narcos. Congratulations. We're getting an education along with our entertainment here. Thank you very much for it.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it.
Wonderful to have you with us today. Narcos, first 10 episodes are on Netflix now. Listeners, thanks for all your input, your comments. Twitter, Facebook, onpointradio.org and beyond. A little more soundtrack from Narcos. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.